When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Now it's time for The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. Good evening, Lawrence.
Good evening, Alex. And we have a statement from New York City Mayor Eric Adams on the death threat that Manhattan District Attorney Bragg received today. The mayor says, while we cannot comment on the specifics of any ongoing investigation, no public official should ever be subject to threats for doing his or her job. I'm confident that every elected official in the city, including Manhattan DA Bragg, will continue to do their work undeterred, and anyone found to be engaging in illegal conduct will be brought to justice. And so that's the mayor of New York's latest statement about this threat to the district attorney today.
It's an important letter, and it couldn't come at a more critical time, given the threats, the stakes, the rhetoric. President Trump has a rally this weekend in Waco, Texas. You know, it is a fraught, perilous moment for the country and, of course, for Alvin Bragg and his office.
It is. Thank you, Alex.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Well, tomorrow morning, New Yorkers will wake up to this cover of the New York Post on their increasingly rare newsstands. Deranged Trump threatens violence against Bragg, who gets death note. The New York Post calling Donald Trump bat hit crazy. The New York Post is owned by right-wing billionaire Rupert Murdoch, who also owns the much more visible Fox Network, where Donald Trump is scheduled to be welcomed back as a guest in primetime on Monday night at 9 p.m. with his running mate of sorts, Sean Hannity, who has actually appeared on campaign stages in the past with Donald Trump. So Rupert Murdoch will find a way to play both sides of this Trump-inspired, apparently inspired threat to the Manhattan District Attorney. The New York Post is actually Rupert Murdoch's least visible media outlet in the United States. The readership is primarily in New York City, where Rupert Murdoch knows there are enough Republican-leaning voters to support a small circulating newspaper, which it is. And there are even more Democratic voters in New York City who like gossip columns, which the New York Post specializes in. And so the print edition of the New York Post, founded by Alexander Hamilton in 1801, survives. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who has been investigating Donald Trump and may be close to obtaining indictments of Donald Trump from a grand jury, received a death threat today in the mail that was sent from Orlando, Florida, earlier this week. The threat said, in all capital letters, "Alvin, I am going to kill you," followed by several exclamation points. The envelope contained a white powder. The district attorney's office issued a statement saying the NYPD Emergency Service Unit and the NYC Department of Environmental Protection determined there was no dangerous substance. A senior law enforcement official tells NBC News that the letter is just the latest of hundreds of threats directed at Alvin Bragg in recent weeks. The death threat was revealed today, the day after Donald Trump posted on social media that photo of himself with a baseball bat aimed at a photograph of Alvin Bragg. In the middle of the night last night, Donald Trump posted on social media that he expects death and destruction if he is indicted. That was his phrase, death and destruction. In their editorial accompanying their cover page tomorrow, the New York Post writes, "In the face of a possible criminal case in New York, he screamed that death and destruction would follow any indictment. He posed with a baseball bat aimed at the head of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. This is Donald Trump. He hasn't changed in the slightest. There is no shame. After riling up rioters, cheering for a coup, and agreeing that his vice president needed to be hanged, he's back to making violent threats against fellow Americans." And then the New York Post's editorial spoke directly to some of the Trump fanatics who read the New York Post. If you actually rose up and were arrested, Trump would abandon you, just as he has every ally who wasn't useful to him anymore. What did he do for those locked up for months over January 6th? The New York Post turned the editorial into an endorsement of any Republican but Trump for president. Americans know that Trump can't stop himself from nursing piddling grudges and throwing out childish insults. The emperor has no clothes. Perhaps you don't mind, but there are plenty of middle-of-the-road voters who do. They saw this behavior in 2020 and the 2022 midterms and said we need less anger and more hope, less rage and more rational action to fix the problems facing our nation. You want a leader who will fight for you? Then you have to pick someone who can actually get elected. Republicans can't throw away their shot in 2024. District Attorney Bragg sent an email to staff today saying, I know it hasn't been easy. We will continue to apply the law evenly and fairly. Donald Trump has been more successful in soliciting death threats against District Attorney Bragg than in convincing protesters to travel to Manhattan to protest the possibility of Donald Trump being indicted. It's worth seeing once again what The Daily Show's Jordan Klepper found when he went looking for protesters who Donald Trump begged to come to Manhattan on Tuesday and protest against the Manhattan District Attorney.
Why are you here?
Because I'm here to support Trump, because they want to indict him.
So Trump went on his own social media, yeah, and he called out people, his supporters, to come out here and support him. And right now, that's just you.
I'm here.
Heavy as a crowd.
I don't need you to come outside. No, I got this.
Okay.
Today in Washington, D.C., one of Donald Trump's criminal defense lawyers, Evan Corcoran, was forced to testify to Special Prosecutor Jack Smith's grand jury investigating Donald Trump's handling of government records, including classified documents, including one classified document found in Donald Trump's desk after a search warrant by the FBI. After an appeals court upheld Judge Beryl Howell's ruling that Jack Smith is allowed to pierce the attorney-client privilege in questioning Evan Corcoran because evidence, quote, that the former president had committed criminal violations. NBC News is reporting today that Judge Howell issued another ruling last Friday saying that executive privilege cannot be invoked by Donald Trump or any of his former staff and the White House staff in testifying to Jack Smith's grand jury investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. NBC News reports that this ruling on executive privilege applies to the testimony of former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and, quote, aides affected by the ruling are former White House Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, former senior aide Stephen Miller, former Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe, former Deputy Homeland Security Secretary Ken Cuccinelli, former Assistant Nick Luna, former White House Presidential Personnel Office Director John McEntee. Leading off our discussion tonight is Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California. He was a House impeachment manager in the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump, and he is a plaintiff in a civil suit against Donald Trump for Donald Trump's role in inciting the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Also with us, Harry Litman, former U.S. attorney and a former deputy assistant attorney general. Harrison Swalwell, let me begin with you. You are a former prosecutor. What is your reaction to what happened in the district attorney's office in Manhattan today with that death threat and what Donald Trump has been doing that might have provoked that specific death threat?
Nice to see you, Lawrence and Harry. The death threat that was lobbed against Alvin Bragg is exactly what Donald Trump wants, and it's why Donald Trump puts out the statements that he does. He wants his supporters to carry out acts of violence in his name. He did it before, and at least up until now, he has not been held accountable for it. I hope that changes through Jack Smith's investigation. But he continues to incite, inspire, and aim threats at public officials. And the aim, of course, is that they would back down. And why not? He saw, you know, the Obama administration back down when he warned back in 2016 that the election was going to be rigged. And when Russia tried to rig the election, we didn't aggressively go after Russia and we didn't call him out soon enough. He told Mueller, don't go after my finances and wrap up this investigation. It's taking too long. And what happened with Mueller? They didn't look at the finances and they wrapped it up under an arbitrary timeline. So Donald Trump is batting 1,000 as far as the threats that he makes to intimidate individuals. And that's why it's important that everyone investigating him right now is fearless, you know, unflappable and does not flinch.
Harry Lipman, Rupert Murdoch has in his version of bravery, basically blamed Donald Trump for that death threat in tomorrow's New York Post. He will not do the same thing on Fox because that network is completely dependent on the devotion of Trump voters in a way that the New York Post is not so entirely dependent on that. But there's Rupert Murdoch's New York Post saying, saying this death threat obviously inspired by Donald Trump. I know that leaves a lot of people in the audience tonight when they see that picture of Donald Trump with a baseball bat aimed at Alvin Bragg's head, wondering, is that legally actionable? Does that represent a threat by Donald Trump to Alvin Bragg that is criminal? And if not, where is the line?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, two things about these threats. They're, of course, despicable. They're also inevitable. And the really important point they're going to be coming is that Bragg and focus on his job. And it's the NYPD and the FBI who will be responding to the threats. On your question, probably not. You know, there's a very high threshold. He has to be immediately inciting violence under the constitutional standard, blah, blah, blah. But he shows every indication of being incorrigible here. And here's what I think is going to happen. He keeps acting this way and gets indicted. Now he's in front of an individual judge who has the authority because he or she has the case to bring him to heel. Say, Trump, Mr. Trump, you have to stop making these statements. We're going to gag you. Otherwise, I am going to put you in jail. And all indications, that will be the time to see whether Trump blinks. He may not, but a judge then acting under inherent power to keep the trial in hand, as opposed to sort of a First Amendment charge, that's when it's really going to hit the road. These kinds of things we've seen today, you're going to have a dozen a week. Bragg has to stay cool and focus on his job and trust that the NYPD and FBI do theirs.
So, Harry, just because I want the audience to have this guidance going into the weekend, what we're seeing with the baseball bat looks like First Amendment protected speech at this stage. Donald Trump would have to say something like publicly, like, would someone please kill Alvin Bragg in order to very clearly be over the line into something where legal authorities could intervene. It has to be a very clear, specific thing.
Yeah, I think he passed it January 6th, but it's got to be incitement to immediately do violence. And, you know, I think probably that picture, revolting and Trumpian as it is, you know, would pass that test.
And Carson Swalwell, your lawsuit about January 6th goes to this very question at the civil level. And so we'll be seeing how that plays out, where the civil standard is not as strict as the criminal standard and that kind of liability. But what is your reaction to this development today where we now know that the whole notion of executive privilege is being thrown out of a possible use by witnesses in Jack Smith's grand jury investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol? This was, it seems, an inevitable turn. There may be an appeals process to that, but Jack Smith seems to be getting ever closer to that testimony.
And that's the way we're going to get the truth about what was in the mind of Donald Trump. What did he have individuals do? And just to take that one step further, that's also the way that they're going to get the best evidence on this classified stolen documents case. Lawrence, what I've learned about Donald Trump from multiple witnesses in the Russia investigation blows my mind, but the guy does not put anything in writing. He doesn't send emails. He doesn't send text messages. I didn't believe it. We had to question dozens of witnesses before I was convinced of it. And then we learned that the reason he does that or does not do that is because he doesn't want anything incriminating to be in writing. Instead, he speaks very subtly. And Michael Cohen said that he would never tell you directly what to do, but he would say it in a way that you knew exactly what to do. But here's why I think he's too cute by half. This is a guy, as we're now starting to see, probably thinks that he's bulletproof, he's shielded, he's invincible if he's talking to his lawyers. And now we're seeing time after time that the special counsel is going after the lawyers and finding that that may indeed be where the crimes are taking place, because that may be the one safe space, you know, the criminal sandbox that Donald Trump wants to play in.
So, Harry Lipman, this is a district court ruling on that executive privilege issue on testimony. Will we be seeing an appeals process that delays that testimony?
Not very much. On the executive privilege point, four people have already tried it. Four people have already gone down. Trump is hoping. And by the way, you saw how what very, very quick work they made of it. Now, that's for the Meadows testimony, which could be huge. On the Corcoran testimony, I think that's the biggest event of the week, because if you think about it, we're talking about 15 months where Trump, just as the congressman is saying, bobs and weaves and says, you know, stalls. It's the crystalline moment when he chose to be a criminal, when he signed, when that declaration was signed. And to, again, to the congressman's point, he's talking to his lawyer then, presuming that it's safe. And we're going to get those very communications, including transcriptions of audio recordings. I think that's going to be devastating on the Mar-a-Lago case. The executive privilege, and unless Corcoran takes the fifth, sorry about that. The Mar-a-Lago case, executive privilege, I think they're going to make quick work of it. And then we'll see about Meadows taking the fifth. Meadows is, hey,
and Lawrence,
the most important witness here. Yeah.
Go ahead, Carson.
Can I just ask Harry, because he's the expert here, if Corcoran is granted immunity, would he not be able to take the fifth and instead would risk contempt, and that's the way to get it?
100%. So that would be the second step, but it's very possible for Corcoran. Meadows, the DOJ would be reluctant because he's such a culpable actor. But yes, that's the way to go with Corcoran. And we don't know yet. Did he take the fifth today or did he actually, you know, follow his lawful duty?
Harry Lipman and Congressman Eric Swalwell, thank you both very much for starting off our conversations tonight.
Thank you, Congressman.
My pleasure.
And coming up, five members of the Fulton County grand jury investigating Donald Trump told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in an interview why they believe perjury might have been committed in the grand jury room right before their eyes. That's next.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Today, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported what some grand jurors investigating Donald Trump had to say about perjury in an interview that the newspaper conducted with five members of the special grand jury that investigated Donald Trump and others for possible election crimes. The jurors did not name names in the interview when they referred to possible perjury charges. In an unredacted version of the grand jury's written report that has been made public, the grand jurors said a majority of the grand jury believes that perjury may have been committed by one or more witnesses testifying before it. The grand jury recommends that the district attorney seek appropriate indictments for such crimes where the evidence is compelling. One of the grand jurors told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, there was testimony presented by a witness, and then there would be questioning from prosecutors that confronts them with a previous statement to the exact opposite. Another mentioned a witness who was asked about whether he or she had prior knowledge of the plan to appoint alternate GOP electors. When the person responded no, prosecutors then presented an email about the electors with their name on it. The Georgia legislature is finalizing a bill that would create an 8-person commission with the power to discipline, remove, and cause involuntary retirement for district attorneys. The members of that commission would be chosen by the Georgia Supreme Court. 8 of the 9 members of the Georgia Supreme Court were appointed by Republican governors. Fulton County District Attorney Fawnie Willis, who is investigating Donald Trump, told the legislature that there are already enough ways to remove a district attorney.
Right now you have impeachment, you have the state bar, and you have the voters. This is unnecessary.
District Attorney Willis noted that in the 2020 election, 14 minority district attorneys were elected in Georgia, including 7 black women.
Every district attorney who represents a circuit or a county answers to their voters, and that is who they should answer to. They should answer to the people that put them in office. This bill was never deemed necessary until an historic thing happened in 2020.
Joining us now is Georgia State Representative Tanya Miller, who is a former Fulton County Assistant District Attorney and a former federal prosecutor. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Representative Miller. First of all, to what's happening in the legislature, that bill, if it does go through and signed by the governor next week, would not take effect for a year. The first possible complaints against a district attorney would be in April of next year. We could see a Donald Trump trial already underway by that time, or even completed?
I mean, that's certainly possible, Lawrence. And look, the reality of this prosecutor oversight bill, or I should say bills, because there were 2 of them. One was born in the House of Representatives, HB 231, I believe is the number. And then, of course, we have Senate Bill 92, which is a companion bill. Both of those bills passed their respective houses. Both are now in the other house waiting to be voted on. We have 2 more legislative days. So it's possible that one or both of these bills will make their way to the floor and will receive a vote. After that happens, assuming they get a majority, which they probably will, because Republicans do have a constitutional majority in our Georgia General Assembly, the bill would be on the governor's desk. We don't know what will happen with Fawnie Willis's investigation by then. I think it's safe to say if she does intend to seek indictments, we will know that in advance of when this commission goes into effect. But again, there's still a lot of mystery surrounding who her specific targets are at this point and what charges she is considering at this point, in addition to whether or not Mr. Trump is in fact a target of that investigation and whether he may or may not be indicted. So there are lots of things that are unknown. But all of the things you heard Fawnie Willis say in her testimony, we have been hearing echoing through the chamber of the General Assembly by members from all over the place, including Republican DAs and solicitors who are against this bill for the reasons she named and for other reasons.
I want to go back to your days as an assistant district attorney in Fulton County. You were serving at the same time that Fawnie Willis was an assistant district attorney there, I assume. What is your expectation based on your experience there about a possible timetable here? As I understand it, there wouldn't be any indictments in the month of April because there is no grand jury sitting in the month of April that could deliver that, or has something to do with grand jury schedules, and that we should be thinking in terms of May as the first possible moment where we could get indictments in Georgia.
Well, I will say this about Fani Willis. I think, and I've said this before, I've been asked this question a lot. She is a straight shooter. She will usually tell you exactly what is on her mind. She doesn't, you know, play close to the chest. Normally, you understand where she's coming from. Again, this is a very important historic indictment. If she decides to bring it, I think she will be careful. I think she will want to make sure that the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. I do not see her rushing to get this done. But I do think they have been working very diligently on this case for a long time now. And I do think that based on some of the things that we have heard or suspect came out as evidence before this special grand jury, there is plenty of stuff there that she could potentially bring criminal charges on if the evidence, in fact, supports it. We know that she's looking at RICO as a possible charge. RICO in Georgia is a very broad statute. It has tons of predicates, everything from perjury to making false statements or writings in connection with government activities, to obstructing an investigation. So there are lots of things that she can do, lots of ways she can craft this indictment. She is a very experienced prosecutor with RICO. Again, she's tried one of the biggest RICO cases in the state of Georgia. It was a historic trial. She was the lead prosecutor on that. She is very nimble with that statute and an excellent prosecutor in the courtroom. She is a prosecutor's prosecutor. So what I think we will see from that district attorney's office is more work to make sure that when they give birth to this indictment, if that is what in fact they choose to do, it is comprehensive, it is far-reaching, and they have the evidence to support it.
Georgia State Representative and former Assistant District Attorney Tanya Miller, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your expertise with us tonight.
Thank you, Lawrence. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up, a new report says that 400 armed Texas police officers did not enter a fourth grade classroom in Uvalde for 77 minutes because they were afraid of the weapon inside that classroom. That's next.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
The monster behind the door was not the 18-year-old with the gun. It was the gun. A new report by the Texas Tribune shows that officers responding to the mass murder at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, did not confront the murderer for 77 minutes because they were afraid of his weapon. Police knew the monster behind the door was not the kid. It's the rifle the kid is holding. That's what Jesse Rizzo said. His 9-year-old niece, Jackie Cazares, was murdered in school that day. The murderer had an AR-15, which was designed as a weapon of war and was first used widely by American soldiers in the Vietnam War in the 1960s. You know what kind of gun? State Trooper Richard Bogdansky asked in a conversation captured on his body camera footage outside the school. AR. He has a battle rifle, a voice responded. Does he really? Another asked. What's the safest way to do this? I'm not trying to get clapped out, Bogdansky said. He has a battle rifle. And so there's a Texas state trooper wanting to know what's the safest way to deal with a mass murderer in a school who has an AR-15, and he wants to know the safest way because he says, I'm not trying to get killed here. And the answer is, of course, there is no safe way. The weapon is designed to kill anyone in the line of fire, even if they're standing on the other side of a wall. In a 1962 Defense Department analysis of the weapon for use by the United States Army, it said that the weapon has, quote, excellent killing or stopping power. That same Defense Department report included a description of what happened when the AR-15, then called an M-16, was used in combat in Vietnam at a distance of 50 yards. Quote, one man was shot in the head. It looked like it exploded. A second man was hit in the chest. His back was one big hole. That's because the bullet from an AR-15 creates an ever-expanding cavity wound as it passes through the body. The entrance wound from an AR-15 is always much smaller than the exit wound. And every one of those terrified Texas police officers who showed up at that elementary school knew that about the AR-15. In an interview, one of those officers said, the way he was shooting, he was probably going to take all of us out. None of those officers were embarrassed by how afraid they were. And they shouldn't be. Some of them are no doubt embarrassed by the failure to act despite their fear. But the fear itself is nothing to be ashamed of. There is no other rational feeling to have in the presence of a loaded AR-15. The radio traffic that day was filled with that police fear. I have a male subject with an AR, Coronado said. The dispatch crackled on the radio of another officer on the opposite side of the building. Well, I can't say what he said. Heck, that officer said. AR, another exclaimed, alerting others nearby. In one of the interviews by investigating authorities after the shooting, Uvalde Police Department Detective Lewis Landry said, we weren't equipped to make entry into that room without several casualties. Once we found out it was a rifle he was using, it was a different game plan we would have to had come up with. It wasn't just going in guns blazing Old West style and take him out. But that is exactly what happened in the end. That is exactly how he was taken out in the end. And there were no police casualties. Zero. 21 people were murdered in that elementary school that day. Children, teachers. 18 of them were pronounced dead at the school. Some of the officers on the scene were armed with AR-15s, just like the murderer. And they were afraid to go against an AR-15 with an AR-15. And that was a reasonable fear. Everyone in that fourth grade classroom was afraid, too. Some of the 19 children and two teachers who were killed bled to death slowly, and they were afraid for every second that they were still alive. Kids pretending to be dead were terrified for every second of those 77 minutes that 400 heavily armed police officers waited because they were afraid of the AR-15 in that classroom. When Joe Biden was a senator, he led the United States Senate in banning AR-15s in 1994. That ban expired 10 years later when the Republican-controlled Congress and Republican President George W. Bush willfully decided to not renew the ban on assault weapons. Every use of an AR-15 in a school in America since then is the fault of President George W. Bush and the Republican Congress, who made sure that on their watch, America's mass murderers were going to be the very best equipped mass murderers in the world. An AR-15 had never been used in a mass murder until 2007, during the presidency of George W. Bush. Last year, the AR-15 was used in 67% of American mass murders. George W. Bush and Republican government did that. It takes 60 votes in the United States Senate to pass a ban on assault weapons, and no Republican will vote for that ban. And so the AR-15 will continue to be the favorite weapon of America's mass murderers. In the early days of the FBI in the 1920s, when they became increasingly aware that they could not effectively confront the famous machine gun wielding gangsters of that era, they asked Congress to outlaw machine guns, which is exactly what the Congress did in 1934. The ban on machine guns passed the United States Senate unanimously. Every Democrat, every Republican in the Senate voted to ban machine guns. The senators from Texas voted to ban machine guns. Texas has very different senators now. Senator Bob Hall is a Republican member of the Texas State Senate. He said this about the 18-year-old mass murderer who shot 21 people to death in that fourth grade classroom in Uvalde. Quote, "This man had enough time to do it with his hands or a baseball bat, and so it's not the gun, it's the person." They will say anything. With his hands. Senator Bob Hall believes that he can walk into a fourth grade classroom and murder two teachers and 19 children with his hands while they all presumably sit around waiting for him to get to them so that he can murder them. Senator Bob Hall thinks that he can walk into a fourth grade classroom in Texas and murder two teachers with a baseball bat and then murder 19 children with a baseball bat. Senator Bob Hall believes that no one would be able to run away while he was trying to do that. The two teachers would actually have a pretty good chance of stopping the bad guy with the baseball bat while the 19 children were running away. It would have been much cheaper for the United States Army to use baseball bats during the Vietnam War, but for some reason, beyond Senator Bob Hall's comprehension, apparently, the Army decided to spend the money and send the soldiers and Marines to Vietnam with M16s so they could kill as many people as possible in seconds. And now the civilian version of that weapon, the AR-15, has come home to do in fourth grade classrooms what it was designed to do in war. And American police officers now live in fear of that weapon, just like the Vietnamese soldiers who were the first to be killed by that weapon. 90 years ago, America knew how to solve a problem like this and ban machine guns. Sanity still prevailed in those days. Five years ago today, I stood on Pennsylvania Avenue covering the first March for Our Lives demonstration in Washington, D.C., with 800,000 people gathered to hear speakers that included our next guest, David Hogg, who had recently survived the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas mass murder in Parkland, Florida.
We are going to make this the voting issue. We are going to take this to every election, to every state, and every city. When politicians send their thoughts and prayers with no action, we say no more. We can and we will change the world.
Maxwell Alejandro Frost was the national organizing director for March for Our Lives. He is now a freshman member of the House of Representatives from Florida. Yesterday, during a House hearing titled by the Republican chairman, ATF's Assault on the Second Amendment, When is Enough Enough? The parents of Joaquin Oliver, who was one of the students murdered in that Valentine's Day massacre in 2018 at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, were removed from the hearing room. Joaquin's father, Manuel Oliver, was arrested in the hallway outside the hearing room. After that, Congressman Maxwell Frost said this.
Enough is enough. Not one more. And to all the organizers, advocates, survivors, and families here today, I'm so sorry that you've had to sit through this hearing. I'm so sorry that you had to see what happened outside to Manny and Patricia, who are just fighting for a world where no other parents have to go through what they went through. And I, for one, believe this has nothing to do with policy and everything to do with politics. And I won't be listening to another second of it, and I wouldn't blame you all if you made the same decision. I yield back.
Joining us now is David Hogg, co-founder of March for Our Lives. He is a survivor of that school shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. David, thank you very much for joining us tonight. I wanted to get your reaction to the Manny Olivers being arrested there outside the hearing room.
It's awful, Lawrence. It's awful to think that parents have to now become activists simply for something that we should all agree on, which is that we should protect our kids and not people like the shooter at my high school's ability to get an AR-15 as a 19-year-old, threatened to shoot up my high school multiple times and still be able to legally own that AR-15. Patricia and Manny should be, you know, celebrating Joaquin's graduation from college. They shouldn't be activists.
David, when we think about progress in the last 5 years, I feel like I'm seeing it when I see Congressman Frost sitting there. There he was 5 years ago helping to organize March for Our Lives, not yet old enough to be a member of Congress. And here he is today in the hearing where parents of a victim of that shooting that you survived were present and ultimately one getting arrested. To see him in that position is the kind of progress I know you've been working for.
It's what we've been fighting for since day one, Lawrence. We've been fighting not to put the pressure on the outside like we're going to be doing tomorrow on Boston Common, and which is why my friends behind me are helping me and others build protest posters and everything like that. We're going to be on Boston Common tomorrow at 1 p.m. Protesting to make gun laws even stronger in the state that is leading on gun violence prevention in Massachusetts. But it does give me hope to see Maxwell out there. You know what really is amazing to me is just about 48 hours ago, I was in Maxwell's office in Congress for the first time. And what really was remarkable to me was I was in there with, you know, one of the parents from Uvalde, but I was also there with Patricia and Manny. And they actually said what's really amazing to them is, although as horrible as it is that they don't get to see Joaquin grow up, they feel like they're seeing the movement grow up in each and every one of us, with Maxwell coming into Congress, with my graduation and other students from March for Our Lives and Joaquin's friends and others graduating. And it gives them a sense of hope. That's why we do this work, to make sure that when people like Joaquin Oliver and his family come to America, fleeing violence from a place like Venezuela, that they know that their kid is going to be safe in their school. And the biggest challenge to achieving the American dream is how hard you can work and how big you can dream, and not having it stolen and shattered by an AR-15 and a corrupt political system that is fueled by blood money that these politicians are getting to put the lives of our children after getting money from the NRA, after getting money from the cartel of death that is stopping progress on this issue that the vast majority of Americans support.
David, you know, it was only today that I bothered to finally look up what was the Senate vote on banning machine guns, when the FBI and law enforcement all around the country said, we got to ban machine guns, these gangsters.
And even Ray Lawrence.
And it turns out, of course, it was unanimous. And that's almost 90 years ago that we could be unanimous when law enforcement and the country was facing a gun in the hands of criminals that law enforcement couldn't possibly respond to.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable that they were able to do that. But the other thing that's crazy, Lawrence, is I know from studying some of that many of these gun owners and organizations like the NRA were heavily involved in it. It's time for action.
David Hogg, we are out of time, as you know. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. We always appreciate it.
Thanks, Lawrence.
Thank you. We'll be right back. President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder and Congressman Maxwell Frost will be on Jen Psaki's show this Sunday at the Bagel Hour of 12 noon Eastern, right here on MSNBC. That is tonight's last word.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.